Welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, October 3rd, 2023. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Looking at the front page of the Courier today, we have a very large photo of a very large table. And the headline is Grout Museum Fundraiser, Famed Banquet Theme of Event. And it shows a white tablecloth, very long table. You can't even see the end of it, and chairs, and the table is decorated. Next story on the front page, providing a home away from horror. Exhibit opening supports Ukrainian students at UNI. This is from Andy Malone, and I'll go ahead and read this one. The United States and the University of Northern Iowa have become a second home for 8 Ukrainian students. That was evident Friday when UNI President Mark Nook gave his personal welcome to the students on the opening night of a Kamarik art building exhibit meant to raise awareness about the Russian-Ukraine war. They were seated in the front row among a crowd of close to 150 people who applauded loudly after Nook's words. Quote, "We recognize your resilience, your commitment to your education, and what you are doing took a great deal of sacrifice to be here," said Nook. "You took a risk that few people in this room would have been willing to take, to travel to a foreign country and get an education," unquote. The emotion was raw when Nook and host parent Brock Johnson got choked up talking about the students' impact and the support they've been shown. They joined Oksana Haferman, UNI Chief of Staff and Ukraine native, in describing what it meant for the university to be their home during the conflict, and emphasized that an army of people have given time and resources to help the students transition to campus. And then it shows a number of photos before I go on with the copy. One shows a man looking at photographs and charcoal and oil paintings at the art building. Another photo shows two people hugging, and the caption reads, "Ukrainian student Lisa Yaroshenkina hosting her host father, or hugging her host father Brock Johnson of Des Moines." Another shows more hugs, Ukrainian student Lisa hugging her father Brock Johnson again, and there's a woman giving remarks at a podium. And then the copy continues. Johnson's wife, Ollie, and Ukrainian student Lisa Yaroshenkina, age 17, rose to hug him as he struggled during his speech. The couple had been host parents to Lisa. It's an example of the love on display as part of the endless stream of support people have been showing the Ukrainians since they arrived on campus for their first semester. The 11 paintings in the exhibit were in the dimly lit space off of West 27th Street and were crafted by Des Moines artist Scott Charles Ross, who is a Waterloo native. In March of 2022, Russia invaded Ukraine. Ross noted that he wanted to craft art related to the horrible event, but had no direction and ended up relying on the photos taken by a photojournalist for inspiration. Quote, "I believe God ordained him to be in the position to open up his heart and use his skills in this way," said Beverly Hansen, age 88, of Cedar Falls, one of the attendees. She had been a host parent to a Chilean student and has refused to, quote, "stay put in my rocking chair," and volunteering her time to help others now. Ross's first and only painting with color was representative of a bombed theater where about 600 people lost their lives. The other linen canvases were composed of charcoal and oil, demonstrating an absence of life, death, and emptiness. Quote, "I was putting my emotions on canvas. What's going on in the world and in this country are very disturbing and got the best of me," Ross said. Ross met the students and asked what his and others' responsibilities should be related to the war. He found his calling in creating the work to raise awareness and selling it to raise funds to help support their education and transition to the United States. There's another photo of a young man speaking at a podium, and the caption reads, "Ukrainian student O.D. Stefanchuk delivers remarks Friday during the opening night of the Kamarik Art Building exhibit meant to raise awareness about the Ukraine-Russia war." Quote, It's nice when all of a sudden something happens here in the state of Iowa, Ross said. You get some awareness and attention, and people stand up and commit to helping out these students. What else are they going to do? They are removed from their parents, and they can't get loans or anything. The quote continues, at least with the temporary protective status, they can work part-time and help themselves through school. But still, they need to exist in our minds. We're sort of taking care of them until either the war is over or they move on with their lives. The art will move around campus in the coming months. The exhibition was on display at the UNI Gallery of Art through Sunday, and will be back on display there as part of showcases from October 19 through November 9. Following that, Ross's work will be displayed at the UNI Museum at Rod Library, located at 1227 West 27th Street through February. In addition to hosting Yarshinkina for nearly 2 years, spanning her time as a high school exchange student and her transition to UNI, the Johnsons also are taking another step to support the Ukrainian students financially. The couple started the nonprofit Humanitarian Scholarship Fund of Iowa in June, and they raised thousands of dollars for Ukrainian refugees seeking any form of higher education, from trade school to a four-year degree. The plan is, eventually, to broaden the aid to all refugees. Quote, there are so many refugee students here in Iowa, and it's hard for them to pay for college, said Allie Johnson. There are no resources. It's a scary thing to have to pay for school, and it costs so much more in this country, said Brock Johnson. Even scarier is what's happening on Ukraine's soil. Yarishkina is one of seven, six women and one man, to arrive in the U.S. in August of 2021 through the Future Leaders Exchange Program and graduate from an Iowa high school. Because of the war, they have not been able to return to their families in Ukraine. Another Ukrainian student, Ulyana Karplyuk, was not part of the exchange program. She and her mother, Svetlana, who was in the audience, were forced to leave the country shortly after the war started. They are living with family in Cedar Falls. Quote, it's very emotional, and it's not happy, said Brock Johnson while reflecting on the artwork. Their homes are being destroyed, and people are dying, but that's what makes their stories so remarkable. These kids are success stories. At the event, the students talked about what it meant to feel welcomed and what they were doing at UNI, but many also talked about where they were from in Ukraine and what they left behind. Quote, my parents are still back there, said Olya, age 17. They were trying to leave in the first week of the invasion, but the line was too long, so they never left after that. When you wake up each morning, you're just grateful. Yes, you may be 10 minutes behind your schedule and you're running to your class, but you're just so thankful you have that kind of experience compared to some other one, unquote. The University of Northern Iowa was able to identify merit scholarships as well as contributions from local donors to help provide support and offset some of the cost of tuition and fees. Even with scholarships, students need to cover costs including remaining tuition, books, room, and board. Quote, we were incredibly excited to see Scott and the university step up, said Brock Johnson. Everybody is using their own gifts to help push the effort forward. And then there shows multiple photos of people looking at the artwork at the exhibit. And the other story on the front page of the Courier, again, it shows that photo of a very long table. You can't even see the end of it, dressed up for a big meal. And the headline is, famed banquet theme of event, strangest banquet hall ever conceived, reimagined for 120th anniversary meal. On a rainy evening in October 1903, a block-long section of sewer between Wellington and Randolph Streets was transformed into what is perhaps the strangest banquet hall ever conceived by man, the Courier reported at the time. The unusual event became famous, reported by special correspondents for wire services, with photographs and stories appearing throughout the U.S. and abroad, including England. On Thursday, the Grout Museum District will hold the 120th celebration of the Dry Run Sewer Banquet. Doors open at 6, with a formal 7-course meal beginning at 7 at the Grout. Celebrity chef and artist Paco Rosic is creating the menu for this fundraising event. Celebrity waiters include Kelly Sullivan, Tara Thomas-Getman, Rob Nichols, and Gary Kroger. There will be entertainment, a live auction, and cash bar. Tickets are $120, and you can purchase them online at gmdistrict.org/sewerbanquet. Seating is limited. Grout trustee and local history buff Mary Potter is excited about the banquet, knowing that the event piques the curiosity of people. It's a fundraiser in an interesting and fun way, and something people will remember. About 450 guests attended the 1903 Underground event. Women wearing high heels and embroidered evening gowns and their escorts climbed down a stairway built for the occasion. Quote, "Everyone came dressed to the nines and arrived by horse and carriage. Lots of dignitaries and city officials spoke. We have a copy of the original menu, which was very elaborate," said Teresa Bryant, development and special events manager. The $100,000 sewer project provided an underground conduit between the Dry Run Creek and the Cedar River. The site at Wellington and Randolph Streets was the deepest point of excavation along the entire sewer drainage route, which extends far beyond downtown Waterloo. Quote, "This was a big deal, and that area was the beginning of a much larger sewer project. Dry Run Creek kept flooding downtown when water would back up around Commercial and Jefferson Streets and 6th and 7th Streets. There was no place for the water to go," said grout historian Bob Niemeyer. Big spring floods and downpours in 1884, 1897, and 1902 particularly were proving costly for business and homeowners who saw their properties repeatedly destroyed when the creek jumped its banks. The city decided to build an extensive sewer system that could divert the flow and make it more, and direct it rather, more quickly into the Cedar River, Niemeyer said. The sewer banquet idea started as a joke among local newspaper reporters, according to a Courier article in the September 26, 1903 paper, I guess. Mayor P.J. Martin thought the idea was feasible, and the city decided to make good and meet the expectations by hosting the elaborate event. Measuring 12 by 12 feet in height and width with a flat floor, the 14-inch thick pipe was a substantial construction, Niemeyer said, and perfect for hosting a banquet. Elegantly decorated long tables and chairs filled the sewer. Lights were strung and elaborate decorations draped on the arched walls. I'm going to go back, listeners, the 14-inch thick pipe. It looks more like 14-foot pipe by what I see in the pictures. I think that might be a typo. Elegantly decorated long tables and chairs filled the sewer. Lights were strung and elaborate decorations draped on the arched walls. Quote, "An open house was held prior to the banquet, and hundreds of people walked through to see it set up for the banquet. There was a carnival atmosphere, and, to put it in context, this was a period of Waterloo boosterism. Waterloo Way wins was one of the slogans at the time. Waterloo was a city on the move," Niemeyer said. Bryant said the League of Iowa Municipalities was holding its convention in Waterloo at the same time, and some of those members attended the banquet. Speakers included League representatives, Iowa's State Attorney General C.W. Mullen, and Mayor Martin. During the banquet, the Beloit Orchestra played while guests who paid $3 a ticket dined on escalloped oysters, roast turkey, veal loaf, Waldorf and lobster salads, devil's food macaroons, and angel cake kisses. A Masonic quartet performed, and cigars and coffee were accompanied by a selection of cheeses and water crackers. For the upcoming dinner, candelabra-laden tables will be arranged and decorated at the Grout Museum. Rosick has reimagined the menu, creating a modern spin on the seven courses, including smoked salmon mousse, a reimagined Waldorf salad, lobster bisque, chicken roulade, ham and cheese tortilla rolls, camembert and apricot jam brioche, and French macaroons and meringue kisses for dessert. At the original banquet, a dry run sewer punch was served, but, quote, "we can't find the original recipe," Bryant said. After the 1903 banquet, the secretary for the League of Iowa Municipalities, Frank G. Pierce, wrote a letter to the editor published in the October 15, 1903 Courier. He noted that, quote, "No other municipality can hope to equal Waterloo's unparalleled subterranean feast until it would be possible to give us a ride in an airship, and hardly then, because if airships ever do come into style, any city can give us such a trip, but no other city will be able to give us a banquet in a sewer." In turning to page A2, Junior Achievement inducts three into Business Hall of Fame. Dateline Waterloo. The 2023 Cedar Valley Business Hall of Fame will take place at 5 p.m. October 12 at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. Presented by First Interstate Bank, formerly Great Western Bank, the Black Tie Gala is the 29th year Junior Achievement of Eastern Iowa has recognized distinguished business leaders who have established a legacy of leadership within their industries and community. Three laureates will be inducted into the Cedar Valley Business Hall of Fame: Dennis Clark of Clark & Associates, Cork Peterson of Peterson Contractors, Inc., and, as an entrepreneur, Rashonda Young of Bank of Jabez will be inducted. The business leaders were nominated by community members and then selected by an independent committee. These individuals were recognized for epitomizing five key standards of excellence: impact on their industry or organization, integrity as an ethical business leader, commitment to bettering the community, leadership qualities, and an entrepreneurial spirit in starting or significantly advancing local businesses. Quote, "We are proud to sponsor the Junior Achievement Cedar Valley Business Hall of Fame in its 29th year, and we cannot wait to celebrate these accomplishments of these great honorees. Their dedication to the community is admirable and deserves the recognition," said Jim Miller, Cedar Valley Market President of First Interstate Bank, in a news release. Highlights of the evening include video biographies of each laureate, and students from local schools will serve as hosts and escorts to reinforce the purpose of the event, which is to inspire children to visualize success. Junior achievement programs empower young people to own their future economic success by enhancing the relevancy of education. Not only do programs help young individuals realize what they can become, but they also help them see what they can change in the community around them. The Cedar Valley Hall of Fame honors Eastern Iowa business people who have shown by example the importance of achieving a high level of success, both personally and professionally. Tickets are on a first-come, first-served basis. For tickets or additional details, you can contact Junior Achievement at 319-862-1100. Our next story, man charged for attack on inmate. This is Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo man awaiting trial for attacking a woman outside a casino in February has now been charged with beating a fellow inmate in jail last month. Authorities alleged Narcissus Artisani, age 50, punched Anthony Charles Smith in the face, knocking him to the floor in pod A3, where he hit his head on the concrete, September 14th. Artisani then stomped on Smith's face twice while Smith was unconscious. Artisani, formerly known as Roger Joseph Hofer Jr., eventually heeded jail staff's orders to stop and return to his cell, according to court records. Smith was taken to the hospital, where doctors found he suffered a concussion and a fractured nasal bone, records state. Artisani was arrested for willful injury causing bodily injury, which is a felony, on Thursday. His bond is now set at $45,000. At the time, Artisani was in jail pending trial for a February incident where he punched a woman as she left the Isle Casino Hotel and kicked her on the ground. She suffered a broken jaw, facial fractures, and other injuries. In the casino attack, Artisani's attorney filed notices of intoxication, insanity, and diminished capacity defenses and requested an evaluation. Artisani also has prior convictions for assaulting other jail inmates in the years 2018 and 2020. Trash fire causes exterior damage, and it shows a photo of a home, looks like vinyl siding melting off Part of the wall has been cut through and just stuff is just melted and all over the grass. Dateline Waterloo. A garage and residence caught fire early Sunday morning, just a stone's throw away from the 3rd Street Fire Station. Firefighters responded at about 2:40 a.m. to 514 and 516 East 2nd Street to put out the flames that spread from a garbage can fire outdoors. The back of the home and garage and the rear of the property sustained exterior damage. Nobody was believed to be in the buildings by the time first responders arrived. No injuries were reported. The property near the corner of Franklin and East 2nd Streets is owned by Barbara Saffold, according to online records, and right across the street from the new All In Grocers grocery store, which is set to open Tuesday. The cause of the trash fire remains under investigation. And missing Nashua teen found dead, Dateline New Hampton. Caden Ray Wilkin, a missing 18-year-old teen from Nashua, was found dead Saturday, the Chickasaw County Sheriff's Office announced on Sunday. Foul play is not suspected. An autopsy has been requested. The Chickasaw County Sheriff's Office received a call at about 5:30 p.m. Saturday related to a missing person search and confirmed a body to be Wilkin. Authorities solicited the public's help Friday in determining his whereabouts. He was reportedly last in touch with anyone at 2:30 a.m. rather on Wednesday. In Metro Briefs, Poppy named as Chief Outpatient Services Officer. Waverly Health Center announced Joni Poppy as the new Chief Outpatient Services Officer. The position will provide senior leadership and strategic oversight to the outpatient services at WHC. Poppy has clinical and leadership experience in the areas of medical surgical nursing, emergency department, surgical services, and as a house supervisor. She's worked in a leadership capacity at WHC since 2008, serving currently as the manager of outpatient services, where she's led operations for the outpatient medical department, cardiovascular services, cardiopulmonary rehab, respiratory therapy, pain and sleep services. She's been with WHC for the last 29 years. Firefighter arrested on charges of setting fires, Dateline Holland. A 60-year-old Grundy County firefighter accused of setting a string of arson fires has been arrested on 13 counts of arson and 1 count of reckless use of fire or explosives, according to the Grundy County Sheriff's Office. Kendall Eugene Rhodes, a Holland fireman the past 6 years, was arrested Thursday after a 5-month investigation into a series of fires in ditches next to cornfields and at buildings on abandoned properties. Authorities determined the Grundy Center man, who lives in the 700 block of M Avenue, would respond with the fire department and insist in putting those fires out. Anyone with additional information is asked to call the sheriff's office at 319-824-6933. At least one of the fires allegedly set by Rhodes is believed to have resulted in an abandoned barn and power lines catching fire. These incidents reportedly happened in July, August, and September, with the exception of one, according to court records. The affidavits stated he drove a gray 2019 Ford F-150 Supercrew to the various sites. He should know the implications of setting those fires and admitted to the crimes after being read his Miranda rights. The incidents include, on April 6th, underneath a bridge of U.S. Highway 20 on H Avenue, just north of 165th Street in Wellsburg, where the East Grass Ditch was set on fire next to a highway that was traveled by several people. July 18, at 16258 J Avenue in Wellsburg, a piece of cardboard was set on fire inside a corn crib, and it spread to an abandoned barn and power lines. July 28, at 180th and L Avenue in Holland, the northeast grass ditch was set on fire next to standing corn. July 28, just north of 170th Street on J Avenue in Wellsburg, the east grass ditch was set on fire next to corn. August 21, 180th Street and K Avenue in Holland, The southwest grass ditch was set on fire next to standing beans. September 5, 170th and J Avenue in Holland. The northwest grass ditch was set on fire next to standing corn. Fence posts next to the cornfield were also damaged. September 8, 140th and M in Parkersburg. The east grass ditch was set on fire. September 12th, he lit more ditches on fire. This was in 150th and M Avenue. In Grundy Center on September 13th, G Avenue and 230th Street, north grass ditch set on fire. September 15th in Holland, south of 180th on M Avenue, he set a grass ditch on fire. September 18th in Wellsburg at, let's see, east of I Avenue on 150th Street, north grass ditch was set on fire. September 25th in Grundy Center, south of 280th Street on L Avenue, east grass ditch set on fire. September 28th at 2:28 p.m. In Holland at 160th just west of M Avenue, he set the northeast grass ditch on fire. And then half an hour later, at 3 p.m. in Holland on K Avenue just south of 170th, he set some dry corn stalks with ears of corn on fire. Next story, longtime Waterloo resident takes another shot at becoming the city's mayor. Dateline Waterloo. A man whose name has been on the ballot multiple times in recent decades is vying again to take the helm of the city of Waterloo. Wayne Natham, age 80, is running for mayor in the November 7th election. One of his biggest goals is to lower property taxes by changing how tax increment financing districts work. He said the city of Waterloo needs TIF recipients to start paying taxes, quote, a lot sooner. The city has 10 TIF districts. When new development is created in a district, property taxes don't go to public services, but rather are diverted to the TIF district to finance development. Most TIF districts have 20-year lifespans before the money is released to the city. Natham wants the TIF process to have 5 to 10-year lifespans. Quote, right now with a TIF district, they're not paying taxes until the 18th, 19th, and 20th year, he said. And the quote continues, it's the citizens of Waterloo who are picking up the property tax bill for those that's getting a freebie in that area, unquote. He said those getting freebies are businesses developing there. Many development agreements in TIF districts include tax rebates to draw businesses to Waterloo. Quote, it's time for changes so they start paying taxes a lot sooner, he said. And by doing that, it'll also lower your property tax, unquote. Also on the November ballot is a referendum to change how local option sales and service taxes are allocated. Currently, 100% is allocated to maintaining the city's roads. The new proposal is for 80% to be for roads and 20% for property tax relief. Natham said if he's elected, he will be, quote, a watchdog for things to go where they're supposed to go, unquote. He doesn't believe 20% will actually go toward tax relief, but it will go to the general budget. Quote, when asked if lost money is going where it should, or it shouldn't, Natham said he tried to, quote, check into that, but no one gave him a straight answer. Even with 100% going toward road maintenance for the past 3 decades, he doesn't think those projects are being managed correctly. He said the most concerning roads are Broadway and West Donald Streets. He said if elected, he'd be able to solve those programs due to his past business experience. I'd take the bull by the horns and steer us in the right direction, he said. He's run businesses for about 50 years. He operated Natham Enterprises, doing business as CBC Freight, for more than 20 years, calling it a mom-and-pop trucking company. He's also no stranger to appearing on ballots in Black Hawk County. Most recently, he ran for mayor unsuccessfully in 2015, when Mayor Quentin Hart was first elected. This will be Natham's 4th run for this position. He also ran unsuccessfully in 1993 and 1995. In 1994, he unsuccessfully ran to join the Black Hawk County Board of Supervisors. He campaigned for a city council seat in 1985, as well as for county treasurer in 1998, both without success. He's lived in Waterloo since 1963, and in Ward 3 since 1970. He said when knocking on doors, many people recognize him as, quote, that guy who speaks up at city council. Quote, I think there needs to be a different face sitting in that seat, he said. I would speak for what I think should be said, unquote. And that's the halfway point of the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, October 3rd, 2023. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. And now we'll turn to our obituaries in today's paper. Robert Lewer Becker, age 71, of Sumner, died September 28 due to complications from progressive supranuclear palsy. Funeral services, Saturday, October 7th, 10:30 a.m., at St. John's Lutheran Church in Sumner. Burial will follow at Union Mound Cemetery in Sumner. Visitation Friday, October 6th, 3 to 7 p.m. at Becker and Son Funeral Home in Sumner, and for 1 hour preceding services at the church on Saturday. Memorials may be made in Bob's name to St. John Lutheran Church or the Terrace at Hillcrest Living, Gunderson Palmer Hospice, or the Charity of the Donor's Choice. Robert Lewer, son of Herbert and Elizabeth Lewer Becker, was born November 10, 1951 in Cresco, received his elementary education in Cedar Rapids, McKinley Junior High, and graduated from Cedar Rapids, Washington in 1969. In high school, he was a talented tennis player, earning runner-up in doubles at the Iowa State Tennis Tournament. Following graduation, he went to Kirkwood Community College to earn his associate degree and completed his education at the Dallas Institute of Funeral Services. He began his career in funeral service in 1973, joining his father at Murdoch Funeral Home in Marion. On June 18, 1977, he was united in marriage to Linda Gald at the Westby Coon Prairie Lutheran Church in Westby, Wisconsin. In 1980, his wife and daughter, Leanne, moved to Sumner. Two more children would join the family, Aaron Marie and Robert J. His move to Sumner was due to an opportunity to work for John and Jane Mills at the Milnes Funeral Home. He often said his move to Sumner, an opportunity to work for John and Jane, was one of his best decisions. In 1984, he purchased the funeral home, and it became Becker Milnes. He continued to serve Sumner, Fayette, Hawkeye, and Tripola for nearly 40 years. Bob had a strong commitment to funeral service and felt very fortunate to serve and be a part of these communities and the surrounding areas. Longtime member of St. John Lutheran Church in Sumner, where he served on the church council and was a deacon. He was an original board member at SEMS and served on the Sumner Municipal Light Plant Board. He enjoyed golfing, especially with his Wednesday group, a group he played with for 35 years, the Iowa Hawkeyes. And he also loved going to his children and grandchildren's activities. He lived a life committed to his faith, funeral service, and more than anything, his family. The family would like to thank the Terrace at Hillcrest Living, Gunderson Palmer Hospice, and all the loving friends and community members for the wonderful care that their dad received. Karen K. Bibb Pierce, age 69, of Waterloo, died Tuesday, September 26. Born February 6, 1954, in Allison, daughter of Elmer and Hazel Cassatz, she married Gerald Andy D. Bibbs July 28, 1978. He preceded her in death in 1988, and she married David A. Pierce on March 5, 2005. Karen attended Waverly High School, graduated from Cosmetology School in 1973, and she started her 42-year career in the cosmetology field. She also worked for Hallmark Cards for 16 years. She loved both jobs. She's survived by David Pierce, brother Roger, many nieces, great nieces and nephews, and many cousins. Preceded in death by her husband, Andy Bibb, Services will be Thursday, October 5, 10:30 a.m. at the Haggerty Wakeoff GRAUP Funeral Service on West Ridgeway, with burial in the Garden of Memories. Public visitation Thursday, October 5, from 9 to 10:30 a.m. at the funeral home on West Ridgeway. Memorials are to be directed to the family. Beatrice Cruz Chung. Our dear mother, Beatrice, age 85, of Des Moines, passed away September 15, surrounded by her children and grandchildren. Born August 18, 1938, in Guam, daughter of Pedro and Rosario Cruz. She was an outstanding student and earned a scholarship to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. There she met the love of her life, Roy Chung. Roy and Bea were married in 1959 in Madison. The rest is a beautiful love story that unfolded in Cedar Falls, where they raised their family until Roy's passing in 2002. Bea was a cherished mother, grandmother, daughter, sister, cousin, aunt, niece, godmother, friend, and teacher. Throughout her career, she taught Spanish, first at UNI, later in Waterloo, Hudson, Gilbertville, and Manchester, and she retired from Hawkeye Community College. She came out of retirement to teach Spanish to three of her grandchildren. Everyone who met her was touched first by her smile, then by her love and acceptance. She is survived by her loving family, five children, 16 grandchildren, 8 great-grandchildren, and 5 siblings. Memorial service to celebrate the life of Bea Cruz Chung will be October 7th at the Dahl Van Hove Schoof Funeral Home in Cedar Falls, and the service will start at 11 a.m., and memorials may be directed to the American Cancer Society in Bea's honor. And now turning to the opinion page, the political cartoon is My View from Mike Lukovic, and it shows a German Shepherd sitting at a desk with a nameplate that says Commander in front of it, and it has a couple of chew toys on the desk. And there's a thought bubble going off the screen, and it says, does Joe Biden give you treats for biting Secret Service agents? Our first opinion is another view from the Tampa Bay Times. Healthcare should not ruin your credit. Medical debt is more a reflection of opaque pricing than it is reckless spending. Many Americans drowning in debt did not get there by spending irresponsibly on televisions, cars, or pricey goodies. Medical bills have become the largest source of debt in collections, more than credit cards, utilities, and auto loans combined, which is why the Biden administration's plan to keep unpaid medical bills from affecting a person's credit score would be a life-altering change for millions. The administration announced a major initiative in September to craft federal rules barring unpaid medical bills from affecting patients' credit scores. If enacted, the changes would potentially help tens of millions of people by removing information on credit reports that can make it harder for Americans to get a job, rent an apartment, or secure a loan. 1 in 3 U.S. adults has medical debt, which between 2009 and 2020 became the largest source of debt Americans owed collections agencies, totaling at least $140 billion, according to research published in 2021 by the Journal of the American Medical Association. That $140 billion doesn't include all medical bills owed to healthcare providers, only the outstanding debt held by collection agencies. Some 11 million Americans have medical debt above $2,000. 3 million people have debt above $10,000. For many, it's a financial hole that only sinks further as they confront more complex medical problems. Medical debt is unlike any other consumer spending. Unlike buying products from retailers, healthcare providers usually provide little, if any, upfront detail of what a procedure will cost. Patients seeking treatment are often bounced between physicians, specialists, clinics, and labs without any clear menu of prices along the way. And Americans seeking emergency treatment are hardly in a position to comparison shop. In other words, This type of debt doesn't necessarily reflect reckless spending, but the opaqueness of America's healthcare system, where prices are shaped through Byzantine formulas involving insurers, their networks, discounts, copays, and deductibles. Debt included on a credit score is meant to signal a person's monetary fitness and, by extension, their financial trustworthiness. Low scores can limit a person's job and housing prospects, and medical debt in particular can discourage some from seeking further health care. Removing bills from credit reports will not erase the debt. Rather, it keeps collectors from weaponizing the information to further harm consumers who typically never sought to incur this expense in the first place. Of course, the details matter, and we'll reserve judgment as the administration develops the rules over the coming year. But this measure is a well-intentioned response to a crisis facing millions and a welcome signal to the healthcare industry to make medical costs more transparent. And our next is from F.D. Flom, who writes for Bloomberg, and she hosts the Follow the Science podcast. She says, "Don't worry about predictions. Global population will collapse. The world's massive human population is leveling off. Most projections show we'll hit peak humanity in the 21st century as people choose to have smaller families and women gain power over their own reproduction. This is great news for the future of our species. And yet, alarms are sounding. While environmentalists have long warned of a planet with too many people, now some economists are warning of a future with too few. For example, economist Dean Spears from the University of Texas has written that a, quote, unprecedented decline in population will lead to a bleak future of slower economic growth and less innovation. But demographers I spoke with say this concern is based more on speculation than science. A dramatic collapse in population is unlikely to happen within the next 100 years. And if we need more creative minds in the world, we could stop doing such a terrible job of nourishing and educating the people we're already producing. Predictions about future population levels don't come with wide margins of error. That don't come with wide margins of error should be taken with a grain of salt. Joel Cohen, a mathematician, biologist, and demographer at Rockefeller University, wants to see population projections treated like a real science with a proper accounting for uncertainty. We don't even know the exact number of people alive now, he points out. When the UN declared we'd surpassed 8 billion in 2022, it was a publicity stunt, he said. The uncertainty in counting world populations is at least 2%, which adds up to 160 million people or more. Since the world population grows at most by 80 million a year, we could have hit 8 billion 2 years earlier, or it might not happen until 2024. Benjamin Franklin forecast that the American colonies would double every 25 years. In 1798, English economist Thomas Malthus applied this principle globally and wrongly predicted this growth rate would continue until we ran out of food and civilization collapsed. This line of pessimistic thinking may sound familiar to those who remember the 1968 book by Stanford University scientists Paul and Ann Ehrlich. It was called The Population Bomb. The Ehrlichs famously and incorrectly envisioned a 20th century starvation catastrophe. They failed to recognize that technology advances might meet increased needs, and that women worldwide would change from having 6 to slightly under 2 children each on average in the coming half century. Today's forecasts account for multiple variables and recognize that population increases are leveling off, not spiking and then plummeting. Some of the most reliable projections, Cohen said, come from demographers with the UN. Their latest estimate shows the global population will plateau at around 11 billion by 2100. A different model created by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation showed an earlier, lower peak around 2064 at 9.7 billion, followed by a steady decline, bringing us down to around $6 billion by 2100. Cohen does not find that alarming. That's about the number of people alive in the year 2000. That inevitable rise in the near term worries Daniel Bloomstein, who's an ecologist at UCLA, who is co-author of a 2021 paper on avoiding a, quote, ghastly future, co-authored with the Ehrlichs. Blumstein points out that the innovations in agriculture have allowed our population to swell far beyond our ecological niche, with unintended consequences. The buildup of waste, especially carbon dioxide, along with the destruction of habitat for wild plants and animals, are now threatening humans more than a shortfall in the global supply of food. And how will society adapt to an aging population? In many countries, the elderly make up a large and growing share of people. Those warning that a population drop could decrease collective brain power and hurt the economy overlook a better solution than producing more babies, taking better care of the ones we have. About 22% of children under the age of 5 today are too short for their age because they don't get enough of the right kinds of nutrients to grow, and because worms and infections compete for the inadequate food they do get, Cohen said. That can affect not only the body but the brain. And Eberstadt worries about future mismatches between skilled jobs and an undereducated population. Taking good care of the next generation is the logic parents around the world apply to their own families. And while it won't solve all of our environmental and economic problems, it's a start. And our final opinion today comes from Stephen L. Carter, a Yale professor. And it's titled, ChatGPT's Endless Stream of Fan Fiction is Not Fair Use. And he writes, the most interesting part of the Hollywood writer's new contract is the AI clause. According to news reports, it explicitly allows the students to train large language models on scripts written by members of the Writers Guild. The agreement implies that permission to train an LLM on a writer's works has value. It follows that the right must be purchased from the writer, not taken. That brings us to the copyright infringement lawsuit filed recently by leading members of the Authors Guild against OpenAI, the company that's behind GPT 3.4 and GPT-4, with more on the way. The complaint contends that OpenAI has violated authors' copyrights by training its programs on scanned copies of published works. It also alleges that OpenAI has contributed to violations by others because users can create what amounts to fan fiction on steroids. As a writer myself and an acquaintance of some of the plaintiffs, I sympathize. But as a longtime intellectual property teacher, the claim related to training likely has only a slim chance of succeeding. The position of the Authors Guild is that the materials on which an AI is trained have value. I agree. So apparently does Hollywood. An AI cannot generate domestic thrillers if it's never read any domestic thrillers. But the courts will likely hold that the outcome is controlled by the 2015 decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, which held that Google was protected by the Fair Use Doctrine when it scanned copyrighted works into its database, in large part because only snippets would be generated to users who tried to search the texts. I'm not sure the court was right, but it'll be a tough precedent to get around. The plaintiff's second claim is a better case. When ChatGPT can produce a detailed outline for a Game of Thrones prequel with the attractive title Dawn of the Direwolves, using George R.R. Martin's characters and settings, well, if that's not an infringing work, nothing is. The developers will argue that they've only created a tool, that they're not responsible if fans misuse it. Most popular novelists tolerate fan fiction because it keeps the target audience excited and expectant as the writer struggles to produce the next book. Fan fiction is not, for the most part, competition. Its existence proves the popularity of the author. But all of this assumes that fan fiction is produced by fans. Human beings are working at what we might call a human pace. For evidence that we're exiting that world, look no further than Amazon's recent announcement that authors of self-published books will be limited to posting no more than 3 per day at the Kindle store. Why? Because of an influx of suspected AI-generated material. The risk, then, is the creation of a constant stream of derivative works. If such stories emerge on demand without practical limit, that's a genuine danger to the incentive to become an author, the precise incentive copyright law exists to protect. A federal court in August sustained the position of the Copyright Office that works created entirely by generative AI, rather, are not entitled to copyright protection. Quote, "Human authorship is a bedrock requirement of copyright," unquote, wrote Judge Beryl Howell. That's a rule derived from centuries of settled understanding. And there's a practical reason, too. Quote, "Non-human actors need no incentivization with the promise of exclusive rights under United States law, and copyright was therefore not designed to reach them," unquote. In a 2019 filing with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, OpenAI argues that training large language models on copyrighted works was fair use, because any other rule would set back research into artificial intelligence. What the Authors Guild is trying to do is turn this around a little to remind developers and users alike that we'd also be wise to allow good old-fashioned human authorship to proceed without undue burdens from AI. Ann Carter, again, is a law professor at Yale University who writes for Bloomberg. And we're running short of time, but I'll do kind of a quick little summary of what's on the sports page. In college women's volleyball, UNI powers past UIC. Panthers remain perfect in Missouri Valley play. In college women's soccer, UNI shuts out Sycamores. Erickson gets 300th win. USHL, Blackhawks rally to beat Dubuque. The Waterloo Blackhawks rallied from a 4-2 deficit, force overtime, and then won in a shootout to beat the Dubuque Fighting Saints Friday. In USHL action, the score was 5-4. And then on the cover of the sports section is a large photo of a wrestling match showing the mat and the crowd. And the headline is, "College Wrestling Northern Iowa, a new home forthcoming." And it's kind of cool because the text is in purple. It says, UNI announces addition of a wrestling facility to the Our Tomorrow campaign. Just skimming, UNI officials have added a new wrestling training facility to its $250 million Our Tomorrow comprehensive campaign that it announced last year. To date, more than $242 million has been raised for the campaign set to run through 2026. And they will be adding a new wrestling training facility. So that's pretty exciting. And that brings us to the end of the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, October 3rd, 2023. I'm your listener, Mary Francis. You've been listening on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. It's been my pleasure to read for you today. Have a great day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.